Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the National Podcast, normally recorded in our studio at the Bishopbriggs Media Centre, currently recorded from our volunteers' homes. To keep in touch with us, use our social media platforms, Facebook, Instagram and Twitter, which are all at Q and Review. That's CUEANDREVIEW. Or get in touch via information@qandreview.com. That's information@CUEANDREVIEW.com. Please like and share our podcasts and give us any constructive feedback.
This is from The National, Friday the 25th of November, from the news section. Accusations of Tory dodgy bevy sessions inside Scottish Parliament. This was written by Craig Magan. Officials at Holyrood have been asked to examine the rules around party political events at the Scottish Parliament after concerns were raised over a gathering held by Tory politicians. An SNP MSP has asked representatives of the Scottish Parliament's corporate body, SPCB, about a meeting on November the 8th, described by parliamentary authorities as a members' dining night. The Facebook post by MSP Alexander Stewart showed pictures of Tory MSPs and councillors with glasses of wine in their hands. His post read, "An excellent Scottish Conservatives event for our councillors and group leaders at Holyrood this evening, discussing all their sterling work in our communities." Stuart McMillan described the gathering as concerning, adding that it was a blatantly political event that went against the spirit of the rules at Holyrood. McMillan has now asked the Scottish Parliament body what rules are in place on members hosting political and party events out with MSP-sponsored events, which he says there are already clear rules against. McMillan said, "Scotland's Parliament should be an accessible place for everyone. However, seeing Tory MSPs boasting about a clear-cut party political social in Holyrood is concerning. Using their parliamentary privileges to undertake blatant party political business definitely breaks the spirit of the rules. It's now time to see if it breaks the letter of the rules too. After my question in Parliament today, I've been encouraged to continue my engagement with the parliamentary authorities to get to the bottom of whether this ludicrous event was within the rules. Nobody is above scrutiny, and the Tories need to prepare themselves to answer serious questions about this dodgy bevy session." When asked on Thursday what the rules were on party political events at Holyrood, Green MSP Maggie Chapman told Macmillan, "All policies direct that parliamentary resources provided by the corporate body to support members to carry out their parliamentary duties must not be used to any significant extent for any other purpose, including party political reason. This includes office equipment, furniture, IT, mail systems and meeting rooms." She said MSPs should use their best judgment on what is parliamentary activity and what is party political. Chapman, a member of the SPCB, refused to discuss specific allegations of rule breaking. A Scottish Conservative spokesperson said, "This was a private dinner approved by the parliamentary authorities." This article was written by Craig Magan. This is from The National, Friday the 25th of November, from the news section. Nicola Sturgeon rubbishes bold Tory claim, NHS at risk under SNP. Written by Abby Garton Crosby. Nicola Sturgeon rubbished Douglas Ross's bold claim that the NHS in Scotland is under threat from privatisation by the SNP. Following a BBC report which said health service leaders in Scotland had discussed the potential creation of a two-tier system that would charge rich patients for treatment, the First Minister was probed over the issue in the Scottish Parliament. During First Minister's questions, the Scottish Tory leader raised the leaked minutes of a meeting between high-ranking officials, which said they had been given the green light by NHS Scotland Chief Executive Caroline Lamb to discuss reforming the health service. Ross asked, is she denying these conversations took place? Is she denying that NHS chiefs discussed a two-tier system in Scotland's NHS? Or is she saying the minutes of this meeting are wrong? Sturgeon said it was bold for Ross to come to Holyrood Chamber and talk about privatisation of the NHS. She added, the Conservatives, who have done more than any other party in these islands, and sometimes they've had stiff competition from Labour, but have done more than any other party to privatise the National Health Service. I'm intrigued, though, at Douglas Ross's line of questioning. I did an interview on Monday addressing the comments. The minute is there. I wasn't denying then the conversation took place. I'm not denying it now. She added, let me let Douglas Ross into what shouldn't be a secret, but he clearly doesn't understand it. NHS leaders, however much respect I have for them, and I have considerable respect for them, do not make government policy. The government makes government policy, and the founding principles of the National Health Service that this government has done more than any to protect and to enhance are not, and as long as I am First Minister, never will be, up for discussion. Ross further claimed that private treatment in Scotland is up 84% since the start of the pandemic compared to the rest of the UK, and then tried to suggest that NHS chiefs were operating without ministerial direction. He added, if the First Minister is to be believed, they're not listening to the Health Secretary, but are going off to fix the NHS on their own, with no government oversight. So, is this yet another confirmation that Humza Yousaf is out of control with Scotland's NHS? The First Minister hit back. Even by Douglas Ross's own standards, this is a pretty lame and pathetic line of questioning. He talks about a two-tier health service. Perhaps he's talking about the one that already exists, where the Conservatives are in government in England. There will not be a two-tier health service while this government is in office in Scotland. Scottish Labour leader Anna Sawa also focused on the issue of privatisation in the NHS, claiming that there is already a two-tier health system in Scotland. He added, can the First Minister tell the Chamber how many procedures were carried out in private hospitals in the past year? The First Minister replied, as I've just said to Douglas Ross, the people who self-fund for private care in Scotland is lower than it is in England, significantly lower, and even more significantly lower than where Labour is in government in Wales. That is the reality because we protect our health service and we always will. Sawa claimed that there were 39,000 patients treated privately in Scotland last year, adding that the figure does not include those paying for private dentistry treatments. The figures include thousands of hip and knee surgeries, costing an average of £12,500 per patient. Sawa said, the number of people now paying for treatment without health insurance has increased by 72%. Often these are the people who are forced to borrow money, turn to family and friends, or even remortgage their home to get health care that should be free at the point of need. Let's look at the facts. Almost 2,000 people have gone for private treatment for endoscopies and colonoscopies. Privately, these treatments cost an average of £1,995. Over 7,800 have gone for private cataract surgery, average cost £2,660. And a staggering 3,500 people have had a hip or knee replacement in a private hospital, average cost £12,500. These figures make clear that under the SNP, healthcare in Scotland is already a two-tier system. The First Minister said she does not accept that there is a two-tier health system in Scotland. She also said SAWA failed to take into consideration the cancellation of treatment because of the COVID pandemic. Sturgeon added, "The one thing that was missing completely from Anna Sawa's question there, of course, was reference to a global pandemic that caused the cancellation and the pausing of elected services in our NHS for a considerable period of time. That's why we've seen an increase in those figures in recent years, but these figures remain significantly below the comparable figures in England and in Wales." That article was by Abby Garton Crosby. This is from The National, Friday the 25th of November, from the news section. Scottish Government announces record high fresh NHS pay offer. This is written by Ninian Wilson. The Scottish Government has announced a fresh NHS pay offer, prompting strikes for Scottish ambulance service workers to be called off. The deal would see a 7.5% overall uplift to NHS salaries in a package that would be worth £515 million in 2022 to 2023, while no staff member would get a pay rise of less than £2,205. The government says that the offer would benefit more than 160,000 employees, including nurses, paramedics, allied health professionals, and healthcare support staff. In a statement, the government described it as a record high pay offer for staff on the front line of the health service. The latest deal would see annual pay rises ranging from £2,205 for the lowest and highest paid workers to a £2,751 increase for some staff in Band 8A. It would equate to an 11.3% increase for the lowest paid workers. All salary rises would be backdated to April. This article was written by Ninian Wilson.
From The National, Monday the 28th of November 2022, from the news section, Grant Shapps says unions should stop grandstanding, by Adam Robertson. UK Business Secretary Grant Shapps has said trade unions should stop grandstanding and get their disputes settled. This comes amid a wave of strike action across the UK in recent months, which has included rail workers, Royal Mail employees and nurses. However, the dispute still involves Network Rail, whose workers are yet to accept any new deal. Passengers across Scotland will still face disruption in December as things stand. Shapps said that the previous Transport Secretaries had spoken with the unions, but that this had not stopped him from announcing a whole new set of strikes. Speaking to Sky News, he said, "The unions seem absolutely intent on causing the maximum disruption to hard-working people in this country. It's time for them to stop grandstanding and, you know, get this thing settled." Shapps served as Transport Secretary earlier this year, until he was replaced by Anne-Marie Trevelyan in Liz Truss's government before Rishi Sunak then appointed Mark Harper to the role. He added, "Fortunately, actually, when it comes to rail, there are lots of modernisations which could be carried out, lots of them which could help pay for their increase, but they don't want to modernise, they want to keep stuck in the 1970s and before, and that's a great shame because it's costing all passengers a lot." The Royal College of Nursing also announced members in England, Wales and Northern Ireland will strike in December. The Scottish Government recently announced that a record pay rise has been put to NHS agenda for change workers following negotiations for trade unions and employers. This led to strikes originally planned by Scottish Ambulance Service workers to be called off. Strikes by the RMT are set to take place on December the 13th, 14th, 16th and 17th, and on January the 3rd, 4th, 6th and 7th. And that report was by Adam Robertson. From The National, Monday the 28th of November 2022, Special Report. The Shaku Bayou Inquiry, Solidarity, Tears and a Familiar Narrative, by Mark Brown. The public inquiry into the death of Shaku Bayou, the Scots Sierra Leonean man who died in Kirkcaldy aged 31 in May 2015, after having been restrained by police officers, reconvened in Edinburgh on Tuesday following a 5-month recess. As it was with the inquiry in May, the reopening of the hearings was an emotional affair. Before the day's business, supporters of Mr. Bayou's family, including members of various trade unions and activists from the campaign group Stand Up to Racism, congregated outside the inquiry venue, Capitol House and Festival Square. Notably, Ross Foyer, General Secretary of the Scottish Trade Union Congress, which had laid on a coach for people wishing to travel through to the lobby from Glasgow, was also in attendance. Chants of "From Minnesota to Kirkcaldy, Black Lives Matter," in a reference to George Floyd. As in the past, the protesters took the knee. The Bayou family's lawyer, Amir Anwar, addressed the Crown, telling them that, contrary to the police statements implying that Shiku was a large man of immense strength, he was, in fact, 5'10" tall and weighed 12 stone 1 pounds, less than 80 kilos, and that the combined weight of the six officers engaged in his restraint was 636 kilograms. As the lawyer outlined these statistics, Adama Jallow, one of Shiku's sisters, was overcome and broke down in tears. One could only imagine what Ms. Jallow and her siblings were going through. Not only were they facing the resumption of an inquiry that would consider in detail the circumstances of their loved one's death, the family had, in recent days and weeks, been subjected to vile racist abuse online. Indeed, so serious has that abuse been that the inquiry chair Lord Bacadale made a pre-hearing not only condemning the abuse, but suggesting that some of the comments may amount to a hate crime. One can only hope that the senior police officer sitting in the public gallery took note and have ordered investigations to attempt to identify the perpetrators. Understandably, it was the statement in the lobby of the inquiry by supporters of the family that made the headlines. But what of the day's hearing itself? The first session was given over to evidence from Inspector James Young, a senior manager at Police Scotland and a former National Coordinator for Operational Safety Training, OST, for the force. Under questioning from the senior counsel to the inquiry, Angela Graham QC, Young painted a picture of safety training within Police Scotland that was woefully inadequate prior to his ushering in a new system in 2016. When he undertook a review of Police Scotland's training materials in December 2014, Young said he found disparities between different parts of the country. This was despite the creation of the single force in 2013. Young told the inquiry that prior to his 2016 overhaul, including a new training manual and 28 recommended changes to safety procedures, there was insufficient emphasis on soft policing techniques. For example, he said, the primary emphasis was on the physical skills required to restrain a subject, rather than the de-escalation techniques, including standing off, whereby officers stayed a short distance from the subject, rather than employing physical force. Prior to 2016, Young said emphasis was placed on distraction techniques which, students at the Police Training Centre at Tully Allen were taught, consisted primarily of a strike to the body to distract a resistant subject. The restraint of Mr. Bayou involved him being handcuffed, put in leg and ankle restraints, being sprayed with CS gas and PAVA spray, and receiving at least 2 baton strikes to the head. Young's emphasis made a strong and repeated distinction between the operational safety training before 2016 and since then. He repeatedly used the term back then to refer to the period before the changes he introduced. You don't have to be Hercule Poirot to notice that the back then that Young spoke of includes the year in which Mr. Bayou died. Nor do you have to be a great detective to note that the implication that, if anything did go wrong, the police use of force against Mr. Bayou, such an event wouldn't happen now. Yet, while these comments imply his death happened during a totally different era in Scottish policing, it was, in fact, only 7 years ago. Narratives such as this, in which the authority concerned, be it a police force, the management of a health trust, or a national government, claims that current methods are vastly superior to the past practice as is under scrutiny, are commonplace at public inquiries. However, the purpose of the inquiry is not to establish whether or not Police Scotland has changed its practices with regard to safety training since 2015. Rather, it is to establish the facts of Shiku's death, whether or not race played a part in the actions of officers both during the incident that preceded his death and subsequent to it. And that report was by Mark Brown. From the National, Monday the 28th of November 2022, from the comments section, Rishi Sunak has shown he's no better than Liz Truss or Boris Johnson. by Kirsty Strickland. The myth that the Conservatives are the party of fiscal responsibility has been roundly busted in recent years. They wasted billions of pounds of taxpayers' money during the coronavirus crisis through a combination of incompetence and cronyism. The Baroness Moon saga is just the latest example of a government that saw COVID as a perfect opportunity to funnel cash to party friends and donors. If that wasn't enough, the sheer idiocy of the Prime Minister, who came next nearly crashed the economy at a time when living standards were already falling. We're all now living with the consequences of those decisions. The yearly debate about when it's appropriate to put the heating on has never been so high stakes. Under this failing UK government, we have people who won't be able to afford to heat their homes at all this winter. With sky-high inflation, rising costs of food and energy costs that have priced millions of people out of such basic necessities, things can't get much worse. When Rishi Sunak was crowned Prime Minister, he promised to do things differently. He said his government would be one of good judgment, good character and integrity. The subtext was clear: I'm nothing like the last lot. The problem is, everything we've seen so far proves that, despite his insistence, he's no better than Liz Truss or Boris Johnson. His own poor judgment is already causing the public purse more money that they can ill afford. We've already seen the Swale of Bravement fiasco, in which a Home Secretary who was sacked for risking our national security was brought back into the fold. Sunak is allowing her to preside over a shambolic and inhuman asylum system that prioritises the demonisation of desperate people over processing claims in a timely manner. Because of delays in the system, people seeking sanctuary are hosted in hotels at considerable cost. We hear a lot of complaints from Tory MPs and the Home Secretary about these costs, as though they are the fault of the asylum seekers themselves. We hear much less about the Tory failures that mean we need to use hotels to house these people. In addition to this, reports at the weekend suggested that millions of pounds in compensation may have been paid out to migrants who were illegally detained at the Manson Asylum Centre. It's clear that the decisions taken by a succession of Tory Prime Ministers to give allies and idiots undeserved roles in government has cost us a fortune. Last week we learned that the investigation into alleged bullying by Deputy Prime Minister Dominic Raab has been expanded to include a third complaint. A lawyer was already investigating two other complaints relating to Raab's behaviour during his time as Foreign Secretary and Justice Secretary under Boris Johnson. The latest complaint is from 2018, when he was Brexit Secretary. It appears Raab has been consistently awful across a range of government roles. The lawyer investigating the complaint will make the final decision about whether Raab broke the ministerial code and will report its findings to the Prime Minister. Time is money, and that phrase is never more true than when we're talking about lawyers. Since the story broke, sources at the Ministry of Justice say they have been inundated with complaints about bullying by Raab. Under the terms of reference, the scope of the inquiry can be widened at any time. With the way things are going, this looks to be a lengthy and expensive investigation. This is far from a one-off. Think back over the last few years. How many inquiries and investigations have we had over the behaviour of Conservative MPs and ministers? How much hard cash has this cesspit of sleaze and stupidity cost us in total? When you add in the considerable cost that are incurred every time a ministerial is sacked or shuffled out, it is surely more than enough to provide every adult in the country with their own 1 kilogram tub of Lorpak. I don't dispute the fact that Rishi Sunak has better presentation skills than his two immediate predecessors. It's just that when it comes down to it, that doesn't matter a jot. Expensive media training and a well-cut suit don't lead to better governance. We are long past the point where this government can be reset or refreshed. There will be no cultural change within the Tories before the next general election, because they still haven't learnt anything from their many mistakes. Despite the warm words and false promises, this is still a party that cares more about its own survival than anything else. Competent leadership and the needs of ordinary people will always come second to that. Scotland didn't vote for this party, and it can't afford for them to remain in power much longer. And that was a comment piece by Kirsty Strickland. From The National, Monday the 28th of November 2022, from the comment section: the sour legacy of Scotland's sugar trade and its slavery complicity, by Dr. Stephen Mullen. My book, The Glasgow Sugar Aristocracy, Scotland and Caribbean Slavery, 1775 to 1838, just published by University of London Press, takes a new approach, placing metropole and colony in a single analytical frame, assessing how each influenced the other. I illuminate the world of Glasgow West India merchants and planters, describe my contemporaries as sugar aristocracy, assessing the scale and significance of the Atlantic trades and the effects of merchant capital on the Scottish commercial, industrial and agricultural change. Through case studies of some of the wealthiest islands where Scots were most pervasive, Jamaica, Grenada and Trinidad, the book examines the stories of many thousands of young Scotsmen who migrated, often on a temporary basis, to the British West Indies in the late slavery era. The Union of 1707 not only provided access to empire, but enshrined the sensitive aspects of Scottish society, the Presbyterian religion, as well as the educational and legal systems. Scottish legal recording was among the best in Europe throughout this era, and this provides historians with the capacity to generate unique insights. Unlike England, Scottish legal recording systematically included inventories which document the personal wealth of individuals. I traced the equivalent of many hundreds of millions of pounds of slavery-derived capital, which was repatriated to Scotland after 1800. My book necessarily raises questions about the culpability and complicity of those residents in Scotland, involved in an integrated Atlantic slavery economy. Many thousands of colonial merchants, planters, African traffickers and migrants were directly culpable in Atlantic slavery. There is obviously a difference in levels of culpability between, for example, a linen merchant in Dundee compared to a Scottish trafficker of African enslaved people in Kingston, Jamaica, but they were all part of an exploitative Atlantic infrastructure predicated upon the exploitation of enslaved people, which ensured the profits returned to Scotland. Manufacturing workers in the 18th and 19th century Scotland had no direct role in slavery as such, but their continued employment and earning potential was dependent upon the continuation of chattel slavery in the Americas. It seems uncontroversial to note that if someone benefited from textile manufacturing, which was dependent on Atlantic commerce, for example in linen or cotton works, they were complicit in an integrated Scottish Atlantic slavery economy. My book has implications for how some of Scotland's most famous sons are memorialised in Great Britain and across the world. By not going to Jamaica in 1786, Robert Burns was not involved with chattel slavery at all. He planned to go and bought 3 tickets but did not cross the Atlantic because his published work, especially the Edinburgh edition in April 1787, became commercially successful. We no longer need to pose the what if Burns had gone because my book provides solid archival evidence of the Scots who were resident in Jamaica. James Watt remains a figure celebrated by some institutions, despite recent research confirming he was involved with the trafficking of an enslaved boy, Frederick, in Glasgow in 1762. My book reveals for the first time that Watt was also a financier of Glasgow West India commerce from 1793, while he was resident in Birmingham, during an era when chattel slavery was increasingly seen as an odious evil. The interest from Watt's loan to the cotton merchants and the denizens likely subsided his retirement just before his death in 1819. The reality is that Watt was complicit in the Scottish Atlantic slavery economy for most of his adult life. David Livingstone worked in Blantyre Cotton Mill, part-owned and funded by Glasgow West India merchants. He began as a child piecer, but was paid high wages as an adult cotton spinner in the 1820s, which, in his own words, funded his attendance at 2 Scottish universities. He was one employee among many hundreds of thousands of Scots integrated Atlantic slavery economy, although to what extent the support his personal trajectory remains open to debate. The case of Livingstone underlines the fact that Scottish manufacturing ranks enjoyed social mobility which stood in stark contrast to the enslaved, whose status as a subhuman property was the very basis upon which hundreds of thousands of lives depended. James Watt and David Livingstone were complicit in Scotland's integrated Atlantic slavery economy for many years, while Robert Burns ultimately was not involved at all. Clarifying prominent individuals' historic connections with Atlantic slavery via verifiable, empirical evidence is not iconoclasm. It is the job of academic historians to rewrite history, or at least historiography. Historians facilitate the identification and analysis of new evidence, leading to fresh contextualization and interpretation. Each advance in knowledge improves how society memorializes. The book adds nuance to hagiographical approaches, exemplified by historic statutory and commemorative practices, and still preferred by some modern institutions. The David Livingstone Birthplace Museum has made Livingstone's upbringing in a cotton mill a key feature of new interpretations. The museum released a statement agreeing it was correct to include Livingston in my audit of Atlantic slavery and built heritage for the Glasgow City Council in March this year. James Watt's story has been partly been acknowledged, but this new book underlines an inherent paradox at the University of Glasgow, an institution with a reparative justice strategy that simultaneously celebrates Watt, a trafficker of a black child in West India Financier in the 1790s. Harriet Watt University has claimed that Watt's attitude towards slavery perhaps changed across his lifetime, and that he favoured abolition in the 1790s, although this myth can now be dispelled. It is up to each institution how they choose to address the evidence my research provides. Despite previous claims to the contrary, my work was politically neutral. Rather than being a pro or anti-Scottish or British, it objectively assesses how Atlantic slavery helped develop Glasgow and Scotland, and how this memorialised in civic space. This book is the opposite of cancel culture. It enhances rather than removes aspects of Scotland's imperial history, posing fresh questions for the nation and some of its institutions. The book can be purchased or downloaded as an open access publication at www.ses.ac.uk/publications/Glasgow-sugar-aristocracy. And that was a comment piece by Dr. Stephen Mullen.
From The National, Tuesday the 29th of November 2022, from the news section. Alistair Jack, Scottish officials could be blocked from Indiwear Freyrk. By Xander Eliards. The head of the UK Civil Service will look into whether Scottish officials should still be allowed to work on Indiwear 2 preparation, according to Alistair Jack. Despite a Tory minister suggesting the Scottish Government can legally spend money on anything it likes. Cabinet Secretary Simon Case and other civil servants are discussing the issue with John Paul Marks, the Scottish Government's permanent secretary, Jack said. Meanwhile, Tory peer and Minister Malcolm Offord asserted that funding from the UK Treasury to the Scottish Government comes with no strings attached, during a Scottish Affairs Committee hearing at Westminster. Offord, who was handed a life seat in the Lords by Boris Johnson so he could take on a vacant ministerial role in the Scotland office, was challenged at the committee by the SNP's shadow leader of the House of Commons, Deirdre Brock. The SNP MP asked Offord and Jack about claims from unionist politicians that it may be illegal for the Scottish Government to spend money in reserved areas, such as preparations for independence. Those claims have been taken further by the unionist campaigner and entrepreneur Robert Kilgour, who is preparing a legal bid in an attempt to prevent the Scottish Government spending in reserved areas. Brock brought up comments from Professor Aileen McHarg, a professor of public law and human rights at Durham University, who called the claims of unlawfulness ludicrous. Offord appeared to agree that the Scottish Government was free to spend money wherever it liked. The UK Treasury sends money to Scotland with no strings attached, he said. It's not bifurcated. The UK Government doesn't do that. It sends it to the Scottish Government and lets the Scottish Government make its own decisions as to how it feels best it should spend that money. However, Jack then said he would like to clarify the point, claiming it was a matter for the civil service. I think on this one, I would hold fire until we see how this plays out, the Scottish Secretary said. Jack's comments seem to have an eye on an intervention from Tory MSP and Constitution spokesperson Donald Cameron. Cameron has written to John Paul Marks, the permanent secretary of the Scottish Government, asking him to assess whether the forecasted spend of £20 million on Indiref 2 preparation is lawful. It was not the only time at the committee that Offord and Jack appeared to be slightly in odds. SNP MP Mari Black asked the pair if they accepted that the Conservative Party have not received a mandate from Scotland since 1955. Jack began to answer, but was shouted down by Offord. No, because it's within the rules of the United Kingdom Constitution, and within those rules we all four of us are together, the peer said. Jack attempted to give his own answer, trying to stop Offord talking to do so, but was unable to speak over his colleague. This article was by Xander Eliards. From The National, Tuesday the 29th of November 2022, from the news section. Air Council welcomes visitor from the most Scottish town in Italy. South Ayrshire has a formal international visitor as the mayor of an Italian town with strong links to Scotland recently visited the area. Provost Ian Campbell was visited by Caterina Campani, mayor of Barga in Italy. Barga is known as the most Scottish town in Italy, with a large number of Scottish-Italian families hailing from the small town in Tuscany. Ties are strong between Barga and South Ayrshire, as many Scottish-Italian families run businesses such as ice cream parlours and fish and chip shops along the west coast of Scotland. We picture Provost Campbell with Antoni Cecchini, Mayor Caterina Campani, leader of South Ayrshire Council Martin Dowry, and Chamber of Commerce President Ilaria Del Bianco in the county buildings in Ayr. That article was by Darren Gibson. From The National, Tuesday the 29th of November 2022, from the news section. Backlash in Scotland over King Charles's Duchess of Edinburgh plan, by Xander Eliards. A backlash has erupted in Scotland after reports that King Charles is planning to hand the title of Duchess of Edinburgh to one of his grandchildren. The monarch is said to be preparing to hand the title to Princess Charlotte, Prince William and Kate's second child and the third person in line to the throne. The plans have been branded feudal patronage of the worst kind by Edinburgh East MP Tommy Shepherd. Says it all that they take whatever titles they want rather than asking the people who live here, he added. The campaign group Our Republic also criticised the plans but said they were unsurprised by the monarch's continuing entitlement to claim ownership of cities at a whim and grant them to members of their family with no connection to them. Charlotte, along with her older brother George and younger brother Louis, were already granted new titles after the death of the Queen in September. The three young royals became Princes and Princess of Wales after King Charles granted their father William his former title over the nation. The move led to a backlaish from Welsh politicians, with Plaid Cymru leader Adam Price saying he did not believe there is a role in modern democratic Wales for the Prince of Wales. Gwynedd, the council area in Wales where Charles was handed his title of prince, saw its local politicians vote by 46 votes to 4 against William being given the title and said it should be abolished altogether. Referencing the Welsh backlash, our Republic convener Tristan Gray said plans to name Charlotte the Duchess of Edinburgh was just the latest of a long line of decisions made with open contempt for the people they claim to represent in their rule. He went on, Gwynedd Council was right to call for the abolition of the Prince of Wales title after a new prince was foisted on them without so much as an indication the people of Wales should have some say in who claims that title. A title steeped in history disregarded by this family. We would like to echo the response of actor Michael Sheen. There is more than one story in these isles, there is more than one tradition, there is more than one history. They deserve better than to be treated as yet another medal to be pinned unearned to the suits of whichever royal fancies them. We hope the city of Edinburgh follows suit and makes clear that if there is to be a person given titles bearing the name of the city, that person should be elected by the people and accountable to them. Alba also criticised King Charles over the reported decision, saying people did not want a new duchess amidst a cost of living crisis. The party's General Secretary, Chris McElhenney, said, We are in the midst of a cost of living crisis. People across Scotland are facing a winter of getting themselves into heavy debt to pay for heating their homes and putting food on the table, making Scots face the absurdity of living fuel poor in an energy-rich nation. Meanwhile, Charles's London government are refusing to accept that Scotland should be allowed to choose its own future, and his Supreme Court has said our Parliament doesn't have the power to allow us to do so. That against this backdrop, he thinks what the people of Scotland want and need is a new duchess, shows how completely out of touch this king is with the reality of life in Scotland. Buckingham Palace has been approached for comment. This article was by Xander Eliards. From The National, Tuesday the 29th of November 2022, from the news section. Chinese ambassador summoned to Foreign Office over BBC journalist row, by Hamish Morrison. The Chinese ambassador has been summoned to the Foreign Office amid an escalating diplomatic row following the arrest of a BBC journalist in the country, according to a government source. The source told the PA news agency that the top Chinese diplomat in the UK, Ambassador Zhen Jieguan, had been called to the Foreign Office in the wake of a scandal after Edward Lawrence was allegedly beaten and arrested by police in Shanghai. He had been covering anti-COVID lockdown protests, which have broken out across the country, in what is thought to be China's largest anti-government movement since the 1989 Tiananmen Square demonstrations. A source from the Foreign, Commonwealth and Development Office said the Chinese ambassador has been called to the FCDO. The BBC has been clear one of their journalists was detained and beaten by police when covering these protests. We have made it clear this behaviour by the Chinese authorities is completely unacceptable. Cleverly, on Monday, described the incident as deeply disturbing, while Number 10 condemned the shocking and unacceptable arrest and said journalists must be able to do their jobs without fear of intimidation. Downing Street urged Chinese authorities to respect those who decide to express their views about the current situation, as citizens take to the streets to oppose the country's draconian zero COVID policy. The BBC said Lawrence was arrested and handcuffed while covering the protests in Shanghai. During his arrest, he was beaten and kicked by police, the broadcaster said. This happened while he was working as an accredited journalist. China's foreign ministry has reportedly contested the BBC statement, claiming Lawrence did not identify himself as a journalist. It comes after Prime Minister Rishi Sunak signalled on Monday night that the golden era of UK-China relations was over. In the speech at the annual Lord Mayor's Banquet in London's Guildhall, Sunak reiterated government criticism of the arrest of a BBC journalist covering COVID protests in China. He said, "We recognise China poses a systemic challenge to our values and interests, a challenge that grows more acute as it moves towards even greater authoritarianism. Instead of listening to their people's protests, the Chinese government has chosen to crack down further, including by assaulting a BBC journalist." But he also warned that the UK cannot simply ignore China's significance in world affairs to global economic security or issues like climate change. Sunak said that with allies, the UK will manage this sharpening competition, including with diplomacy and engagement. This article was by Hamish Morrison. From The National, Tuesday the 29th of November 2022, from the news section. Grangemouth nuclear reactor plans will be shot down, government vows. By Hamish Morrison. Any plans to power Scotland's last remaining oil refinery with a nuclear reactor will be blocked by ministers, the government has confirmed. The Times reports that INEOS, the firm which partly owns the Grangemouth refinery, is in talks with engineering firms Rolls-Royce to power the site with a nuclear reactor, despite long-standing and stubborn opposition to the technology from the Scottish Government. The Scottish Government has now reaffirmed its opposition to any plans to build the reactors in the country, because they use nuclear fission. A spokesperson said, "The Scottish Government is absolutely clear in our opposition to the building of new traditional nuclear fission energy plants in Scotland under current technologies. Small modular reactors, SMR, while innovative in construction and size, still generate electricity using nuclear fission, and therefore the process presents the same environmental concerns as traditional nuclear power plants. We believe that significant growth in renewables, storage, hydrogen and carbon capture provides the best pathway to net zero by 2045 and will deliver the decarbonisation we need to see across industry, heat and transport. The Scottish Government has a long-standing policy of using planning policy as a workaround to ban nuclear sites in Scotland. It does this because energy policy is a reserved matter, but ministers are able to frustrate efforts by using planning restrictions which block nuclear projects." Rolls-Royce confirmed it was in talks with a number of industrial customers about using its SMRs for new energy generation, but did not mention Grangemouth specifically. A spokesperson for the firm said, Rolls-Royce SMR is talking to a number of industrial customers who see huge potential in using our UK-developed technology to provide affordable, long-term, low-carbon electricity generated from a sustainable source. We do not comment publicly on any commercial discussions. In addition to generating low-carbon electricity for the grid, its small footprint and factory-built approach means the Rolls-Royce SMR can be deployed to power energy-intensive industrial processes, including the production of hydrogen and synthetic fuels. INEOS declined to comment. This article was by Hamish Morrison.
From The National of Tuesday, the 29th of November, 2022, from the comment section, the IndyRef ruling has laid bare the undemocratic union for all to see, by Karen Adam. As many people did, I signed up to join the SNP the day after the independence referendum in 2014. It wasn't that I was never political before that moment, but I had never felt the need to join a movement as strongly as I did that morning. I had volunteered my time to the Yes movement in 2014, but hadn't quite pinned my party political colours to the mast, so to speak. Yet I have always been a part of a political family. My parents were outspoken on many topics and were very much involved with the SNP since the late 1960s. My mother's daily rants about Margaret Thatcher were something I had been accustomed to over the years, particularly during my childhood in the 1980s. I was always a voter and I was always paying attention, but I just didn't have the time to be fully politically active while raising my children. There's a time and season for everything, and for politics, my season kicked off in 2014. I'm sure we all remember the Eat Your Cereal advert. It absolutely boiled my blood. I had been raising children since 1991, and if there was something I knew, it was the need for women's voices in education, healthcare, infrastructure and housing, among many other issues in which I had become a wee bit of an expert in during my household managerial years. The patronising attempt to exclude women from the debate when many of us ran households unpaid, taking more hours than a full-time job and organisational skills to get right, filled me with utter rage. I was a carer and had lived experience of many challenges which I wanted to use to help improve services. I felt I just had to take to the streets as an activist to combat that patronising messaging. I knew that independence meant building a future I could help shape, and I knew that politics was for me and my children as much as it was for anyone else. The message on the doors at that time was very much about Scotland having a role to play as its own voice in the world, one that wasn't advocated for, but one that could advocate for itself and its own citizens. I suppose I had the benefit of not being aligned with any political party at that time, as I could make the case for a politically neutral standpoint when challenged with debate on SNP policy. This was a tactic I saw time and again by opponents to independence, the tearing down of anything SNP, the undermining of the party's voice, and the attempts to smear the credibility of anything it would promote, independence being one of those things. I have always argued the case for this being about democracy and fairness. Believe it or not, as the Facebook rants intensified, I found an ally in a Conservative for Yes, as he too saw the possibilities of independence for his political beliefs. I believe many others cross-party did too. I wonder what happened to them and what their thoughts are on last week's decision by the Supreme Court. As the decision was revealed, I found myself incredibly frustrated at the messaging once again coming from pro-union parties. To ask for the decision to be respected is indeed a false narrative, How could we not respect it? We are bound to it and we must abide by it. That's exactly what the problem is. They are counting on the public assuming the ruling was against the Scottish Government having a referendum when it was interpreting the law as to whether we can legally initiate a referendum without the consent of Westminster. The pro-union parties seem to be in a bit of a fluster about this, for they know fine well their undemocratic union was laid bare for all to see. We are certainly not in a consensual or equal union. I found it intriguing that once again the pro-independence side saw this as an opportunity to galvanise and gather, while the pro-union side didn't have much to say. Very subdued and unprepared, I thought. For us, there's nothing more motivational than being told no when it's a matter of justice. As I watched the reactions to the ruling unfold, I thought my head was going to shake off my shoulders. I was in utter disbelief at some of the takes. One was especially facepalm-inducing. I watched as somebody spoke on local TV in Aberdeen, citing that the ruling was to be celebrated as they didn't like what the SNP had to offer. I just couldn't believe that anyone would take from this a party narrative. If the parties they were supportive of had had the roles reversed, would they be as keen on the ruling? As ultimately, this has uncovered a clear statement that there is no straight path to a referendum regardless of who or what we vote for. That should shake any Democrat to the core. We must have the right to self-determination and to govern how we choose economically, socially and culturally. This is recognised by individual law for individuals, so why not for the individuals of Scotland? The question is not who we want to run Scotland, but rather who should run Scotland. Time and again, since 2014, we have voted consistently for the SNP pledge of holding a referendum. We know we have been given a mandate by the people, and to deny the obvious is shameful for anyone. To be satisfied with a court ruling stating we need the permission of another country to pursue a referendum is to deny true democracy. This kind of political subjugation has no place in any modern society. There are, of course, other paths to independence that we can take, and although they may be rough, nothing worthwhile ever came easy. There's a time and a season, and our time is now. This article was by Karen Adam. From The National of Tuesday the 29th of November 2022, from the comment section, we Ginger Doug, the term unionist should be expunged from discourse. The opponents of independence, whom we now call Anglo-British nationalists, following last week's Supreme Court ruling, will employ fair means or foul, but mostly foul, in order to prevent that popular vote on Scottish independence that they view with such dread. But first of all, we need to deal with the matter of nomenclature. During the 2014 referendum campaign, the opponents of independence were very successful in framing it as a debate between nationalists, who wanted independence on the one hand, and non-nationalist unionists on the other, ensuring that it was the yes side which was lumbered with all the negative baggage that the term nationalist carries with it. This ensured that some people who might otherwise have been receptive to the independence message were turned off because they considered themselves opposed to nationalism. The Supreme Court ruled that in the eyes of the British state, Scotland is subordinate to a parliament overwhelmingly elected by voters in England and in which Scotland's representatives are a small and permanently ineffectual minority which cannot hope to overcome decisions that affect Scotland made by that huge majority of English MPs. This is why we have Brexit and all its negative consequences, despite the fact that Scotland rejected it in the 2016 referendum and has consistently voted for parties opposed to Brexit ever since. The Supreme Court ruled that there is no path to another referendum which Scotland can use to achieve a vote by means of its own internal democratic processes, putting a lie to the generations long claim so beloved of anti-independence politicians that the UK is a voluntary union of nations which accepts that it is up to the people of Scotland to decide whether Scotland remains a part of the UK. In addition, the Supreme Court went out of its way to rub salt in the wound by ruling that Scotland has no right to self-determination. The parties campaigning to oppose Scottish independence are therefore campaigning to maintain Scotland's subordinate status in an unequal state, the membership of which is only voluntary for its largest constituent nation, and which denies to Scotland the right to self-determination, which is axiomatic for England. These parties are not unionist in the sense in which we have traditionally presented themselves. They are not advocating Scottish participation in an equal and voluntary union that respects Scotland's centuries-long nationhood and historic understanding of Scottish sovereignty. No, they are advocating that Scotland remains in a polity in which Holyrood and Scotland's legal and political traditions are subject to the whims of a parliament which is overwhelmingly composed of MPs elected to represent English constituencies on the basis of English political concerns, and in which the Scottish Parliament has no greater legal or constitutional foundation than an English county council. This is not some form of lofty non-nationalist unionism, which is a higher and more dignified philosophy than mere grubby nationalism. It is mere grubby nationalism. It is Anglo-British nationalism. Just because the parties opposing independence are in deep denial about their own nationalism and refuse to recognise it for what it is, does not mean that supporters of Scottish independence must collude in their delusion. We do ourselves no favours and deliver an open goal to our opponents by doing so. We must call out Anglo-British nationalism for what it is. The Scottish independence debate is not a debate between nationalism and non-nationalism. It never has been. But in the aftermath of the Supreme Court ruling, it is clearer than ever that the Scottish constitutional debate is a debate between two nationalisms, civic Scottish nationalism on the one hand and hegemonic and frankly imperialist Anglo-British nationalism on the other. After the Supreme Court ruling, it is time to expunge the term unionist from current Scottish political discourse. The term is a historical relic belonging to a bygone age in which Scotland could tell itself that it was an equal partner in a voluntary union of nations. It has no more modern political relevance than the terms Jacobite, Covenanter or Home Ruler. All there are now are supporters of Scottish independence or proponents of Scotland's political subordination to a state which is the political and constitutional expression of Greater England. There are no unionists anymore. There are only Anglo-British nationalists who wish for Scotland to remain dominated and unable to determine its own fate. This article was by Wee Ginger Doug.
The National. Politics on Wednesday the 30th of November. Michelle Moon to keep Tory whip until PPE probes are over, party confirms. An article written by Ninian Wilson. Michelle Moon will keep the Tory whip until official probes into PPE MedPro have concluded, a party spokesperson has confirmed. A Tory spokesperson in the Lords has reportedly said that the decision has been made that she will retain the whip. The Tory business tycoon is currently under investigation following reports from The Guardian that she received £29 million in profits from a PPE business that won large government contracts after she recommended it to ministers. The National Crime Agency and the House of Lords Standards Committee are both investigating the firm's dealings. Baroness Moon reportedly backed the company to get a spot in the government's VIP lane, which fast-tracked businesses in the running for supply deals during the pandemic. Profits made by the company were allegedly transferred to an offshore trust, which received tens of millions of pounds that Baroness Moon and her children benefited from. It's claimed by The Guardian that her husband, Douglas Barrowman, was paid a minimum of £65 million by the firm before distributing the funds through trusts, companies and offshore accounts. Overall, Baroness Moon and her family reportedly made around £29 million in profits, sparking outrage among the public. An online petition has currently registered over 130,000 signatures calling for Baroness Moon's removal from the House of Lords over the scandal. The petition also demands that every penny in profit that she took from the taxpayer is repaid immediately. It adds, corruption has no place in politics. Conservative peer Michelle Moon is reported to have secretly pocketed £29 million of public money during the pandemic for unsafe PPE that couldn't even be used, all while her NHS heroes were putting their lives on the line, including by wearing DIY PPE to protect themselves and the public during the pandemic. A note at the bottom of the petition continues, if Baroness Moon used her influence as a Tory peer to pocket millions of pounds for herself, she should not only lose her seat in the Lords, she should have to pay back every penny. An article written by Ninian Wilson. The National, on Wednesday the 30th of November. Opinion. Commons treatment of my colleague John Nicholson was unedifyingly ugly. A column written by Pete Wishart, MP. Yesterday was quite an extraordinary day in Westminster, and believe me, I've seen a number of extraordinary days in my 21 years in the place. My colleague John Nicholson was subject to a parliamentary vote as to whether or not the Privileges Committee of the House of Commons should investigate a breach of the House rules and determine a sanction. John's alleged crime was to post a short video on Twitter expressing his disappointment that the Speaker didn't support a referral to the Privileges Committee of the former Secretary of State for Culture. The House passed John's referral by an overwhelming majority. Now let's get to the Privileges Committee. The committee is responsible for adjudicating the conduct of the members of the House and can impose sanctions up to and including suspension. It usually deals with the most egregious behaviour, think Owen Paterson's outside earnings or Boris Johnson's partying, to get a sense of its usual day-to-day business. I've never known it to consider something on Twitter or correspondence with the Speaker, but John will now face its full force and could ultimately face suspension from the House. What I think angered the House is that John is adjudged to have upset the Speaker by betraying the contents of a letter sent to him and disclosing its details. The thing is, John did not disclose any letter but merely summed up its contents. I'm in my seventh term in Parliament and have even served on the House of Commons Commission, and I'd no idea that stating or summarising a response from the Speaker was an offence that could result in a suspension. I think most MPs would be totally unaware of such a rule. John, of course, apologised for not knowing the rules and for any perceived offence that was felt by the Speaker. But that was not enough. The proverbial pound of flesh was to be secured, hence the motion. I have to say, I've never seen the House so intent on getting its man, and what ensued was the worst type of institutional bullying from the highest institution in the land. Yesterday was a black day for Parliament. I don't know why John was picked on in this way, but it was unedifyingly ugly. People ask us why we want away from Westminster. Yesterday gave another example as to why we must get out of its clutches as soon as possible. A column written by Pete Wishart, the SNP MP for Perth and North Perthshire. The National, on Wednesday the 30th of November. Opinion. The monarchy question must be answered after independence. A column written by the Wee Ginger Doug. Despite the ruling of the UK Supreme Court last week effectively instructing Scotland to get back in its box and leave questions of Scotland's status to our betters in Westminster, this so-called United Kingdom gives every appearance of coming apart at the seams. A few decades ago, the news that the British monarch was giving one of the grandchildren the title to the Duchy of Edinburgh would have been warmly applauded by much of Scotland as a symbol of the unity of the kingdom and ignored by the Republican minority as an irrelevance. Now, however, in this unitary state that masquerades as a union, in which Scotland has been informed in no uncertain terms that it's politically and constitutionally subordinate, the news that King Charles, and I will still keep mentally adding Spaniel whenever anyone says that, is reportedly planning to award his young granddaughter Charlotte the title of the Duchess of Edinburgh has been met in Scotland with widespread derision. No one is blaming the child Charlotte, she's only 7 years old and as such has no real understanding of how she's being used as a political pawn to bolster support for a dying pretendy union. Sadly, however, if the rest of her deeply dysfunctional family is anything to go by the time she's old enough to understand what's going on, she will most likely regard the immense wealth and privilege into which she's been born as her entitlement. However, by that time, at the rate at which the UK is unravelling, her title will become as irrelevant as those of those Irish peers who continued to sit in the House of Lords following Irish independence in 1922. Very few realised that Edinburgh was a duchy, and even fewer cared. However, rather more care that Scottish territory can be parcelled up and doled out to aristos like fancy baubles they can add to their title collections, as if they were football stickers needed to complete a set. Naturally, we mere plebs who live in these quasi-colonial possessions were not consulted on whether we agree with the appointment of our new aristocratic overlords. Edinburgh SNP MP Tommy Shepherd condemned the plan to hand the title Duchess of Edinburgh to the King's granddaughter, a child with no connection to the city, as feudal patronage of the worst sort, and added, says it all, that they take whatever titles they want, rather than asking the people who live here. The royals have a collection of Scottish titles, such as Will and Kate holding the titles Earl and Countess of Strathearn, titles which only get an outing when the supine British media informs us that the couple are known in Scotland as the Earl and Countess of Strathearn. Speaking as an actual Scottish person who lives in Scotland and who knows a great many other actual Scottish people, I can assure the British media that the couple are not known in Scotland as the Earl and Countess of Strathearn. They're instead known in Scotland by a range of colourful epithets, most of which cannot be printed in a family newspaper. Charles's brother Andrew, the discredited and disgraced former friend of sex traffickers, still possesses the title the Earl of Inverness, a title he's made use of in some of his highly questionable business dealings. There's undoubtedly widespread antipathy to the monarchy in Scotland, and there seems to be little doubt that in the normal course of events, this country would be seeking to emulate Barbados and declare itself a republic. Certainly, that would be my personal preference. However, we must be careful not to tie the independence movement too closely to republicanism. Scotland, as an independent state, was a monarchy for centuries, and there are still those who would prefer a slimmed-down and more accessible Scots monarchy, perhaps along more Scandinavian lines. The question of the monarchy is for the people of Scotland to decide after independence. We can be certain that it's not a question that the British state will ever allow Scotland to decide, just like it will not allow us to decide for ourselves whether we want to revisit the question of Scotland's relationship with the other nations in this not a union. A column written by the Wee Ginger Doug. The National News on Wednesday the 30th of November. France celebrates Scottish salmon on St Andrew's Day. An article written by Megan Canner. Scottish salmon was celebrated in Paris during a St Andrew's Day reception. The event was held at the British Embassy in the French capital, with government officials and local media outlets invited. This year marks the 30th anniversary of Scottish salmon holding the prestigious Label Rouge quality mark, which is the official recognition by French authorities of the superior quality of food or farmed products. The market for Scottish salmon is booming in France and is at an all-time high. Exports in 2019 were £221 million, which rose to £304 million last year. Scottish Rural Affairs Secretary Marie Gugin and acclaimed chef Heroes Abbe attended the event. Ms Gugin said, "This week, as we celebrate all that Scotland has to offer on our national holiday, St Andrew's Day, it's fitting that the Scottish salmon success story is high up on the agenda. I was pleased to be in Paris to continue the close collaboration between the governments of Scotland and France, and to consider ways in which we can support exports of salmon to the EU and France in particular. France is the largest export destination for Scottish salmon and accounts for just over 80% of all Scottish salmon exports to the EU. Together with our French counterparts, we marked the 30th anniversary of Scottish salmon having Label Rouge certification, the first non-French product to be awarded Label Rouge accreditation." Tavish Scott, Chief Executive of Salmon Scotland, hailed Scotland's collaboration with France. He said, "These days, Scotland and France collaborate on products and markets, and we're immensely proud to be at the heart of this new Old Alliance Gastronomique." Mr. Scott also added that salmon companies have overcome the new bureaucratic difficulties caused by Brexit to bring salmon to France as quickly and efficiently as possible. An article written by Megan Canner. The National Politics on Wednesday, the 30th of November. UK's Great British Nuclear Plan to Leave Toxic Legacy for Centuries. An exclusive article written by Xander Eliads. Westminster's new Great British Nuclear government body will leave a toxic legacy for centuries, the Scottish Greens have warned. The Tories announced plans to launch and fund the new arm's-length government body in order to develop a resilient pipeline of new nuclear projects across England. The UK government has further announced that Sizewell C, a nuclear project on the Suffolk coast, will be the first to be paid for through the regulated asset base funding model. This model will see energy bill payers across the UK, including in Scotland, where the elected government opposes the technology, pay more on top of already skyrocketing bills in order to fund the construction of the Suffolk plant. As Great British Nuclear identifies further nuclear projects to be funded through this model, energy bills for UK consumers will rise still further. On top of paying for the nuclear sites through their energy bills, the UK government has said it will invest £700 million of taxpayer money in building Sizewell C. The Scottish Greens environment spokesperson Mark Ruskell criticised the mass expenditure, saying renewables would be a better investment. He told The National, "Nuclear power is inefficient, dangerous, and will leave a long and toxic legacy for centuries. Sizewell C will cost tens of billions of pounds that will need to be paid for while millions of people are struggling to make ends meet." He went on, "This is a time when we must be investing in the renewable industries of the future. Renewable energy is far cheaper, cleaner and safer than nuclear. We can also get them scaled up far quicker than the decade it will take to open Sizewell C. With the powers of a normal independent country, we could do so much more to build a cleaner and greener future. It would allow us to invest in our communities and ensure lasting jobs and sustainable industries that have a future." The UK government has insisted that Great British Nuclear will ensure projects offer clear value for money for taxpayers and consumers. They said they were working at pace to set up the body, with an announcement expected in the new year. A spokesperson said in a news release, "The UK government can confirm today that it will back Great British Nuclear with funding to enable the delivery of clean, safe electricity over the decades to come, protecting future generations from the high price of global fossil fuel markets." However, former chief statistician at the Scottish Office, Jim Cuthbert, who's penned a report on regulated asset base for the Commonweal think tank, warned that the funding model would likely lead to massive windfall profits for operators rather than value for consumers. He told The National, regulated asset-based funding is particularly unsuited to nuclear projects because of the long construction periods for new nuclear plants and the long period during which a plant will be in operation. Both factors will lead to overcharging and the potential for the consortium operators to extract large windfall profits, as a recent report of mine demonstrated. In addition, with regulated asset base, consumers will start to pay now, many years before they will begin to receive electricity from the new plants. We, the consumers, will incur large costs for which we'll be inadequately compensated. The UK government said the Sizewell C plant was at the heart of the new blueprint to Britain's energy sovereignty, claiming it would create as many as 10,000 highly skilled jobs. Business and Energy Secretary Grant Shapps said global gas prices are at record highs caused by Russian President Vladimir Putin's illegal march on Ukraine. We need more clean, affordable power generated within our borders, British energy for British homes. Today's historic deal, giving government backing to Sizewell C's development, is crucial to this, moving us towards greater energy independence and away from the risks that a reliance on volatile global energy markets for our supply comes with. This is at the heart of a package of measures that, together with the new Great British Nuclear and powers of the Energy Security Bill, will ensure secure supply for now and for generations to come. An exclusive article written by Xander Eliads.
This article is from The Herald. On Monday, the 28th of November, 2022. It's from the opinion section, and the headline is "The Heidi Crotter Abortion Ruling Should Concern Us All." The report is by Kevin McKenna. In the early months of COVID-19, the Scottish and UK governments attempted to normalise the concept of state-sponsored euthanasia in the care home sector. It was only after a public outcry, born on what we considered to be a basic sense of morality, that this approach was halted. During this time, more people died of the virus in Scotland's care homes than in hospital. Sacrificing the lives of the elderly and the infirm was considered to be an acceptable emergency measure in the teeth of a lethal contagion. As a means of freeing up space for the young and the fit, our governments chose to discharge old people from hospital straight into care homes without first being tested for the virus. Almost overnight, these places, lacking adequate supplies of PPE and staff training, were turned into death camps. In many instances, care home staff, suspecting something sinister was happening, were ordered not to discuss their concerns. Amnesty produced a 50-page report on similarly iniquitous attitudes in England. The report, as if expendable, the UK government's failure to protect older people in care homes during the COVID-19 pandemic, showed that the elderly in care were effectively tossed overboard during the health crisis. It seemed that attitudes among the UK's political class hadn't changed much since the Black Death in the 14th century. At the first major sign of adversity, all those hallmarks we consider to be characteristic of a modern, progressive and enlightened society simply evaporated. Social progress, scientific expertise, constantly groundbreaking medical advances counted for nothing if you were unlucky enough to be old and not quite in full possession of your mental and physical faculties. You know how you've been thinking about death quite a lot lately, Mr. Smith? Well, don't be planning too far ahead. Just saying, like, Heidi Crotter isn't old though. She's only 27 and is bright, articulate and bubbly. Like many other people who have Down syndrome, she is surrounded by people who love her and want her to live her best life. And if Heidi is anything like my niece Kira, she'll be bringing a lot of happiness to her family and friends. Last Friday, though, Miss Crotter found that, like those vulnerable and elderly people in the early months of COVID, society doesn't consider hers a life worth living at all. Not really. three senior Court of Appeal judges dismissed her appeal of a High Court judgment last year in a case brought against the Department of Health and Social Care about changing the law on abortion. Specifically, it challenged the legislation which allows the abortion of babies with Down syndrome up until birth. Along with Moira Lee Wilson, the mother of Aidan, a young boy who has Down syndrome, Ms. Croter thinks this part of the 1990 Abortion Act is incompatible with the European Convention on Human Rights. Dismissing her appeal, the judges said that abortion laws were for Parliament to decide and that the Act did not interfere with the rights of the living disabled. They were wrong, and grievously so. An investigation by the Sunday Times last year found that the number of babies born with Down syndrome fell by around 30% in those hospitals deploying a new prenatal testing technique called cell-free DNA. It's effectively another step in ensuring that, in the future, people with Down syndrome will no longer exist. And when this happens, then the rest of us had better start looking over our shoulders. By its most widely accepted definition, eugenics is the study of how to arrange reproduction within a human population to increase the occurrence of heritable characteristics regarded as desirable. We saw where that led in Europe 80 years ago. This sewage is now lapping at our ankles in 21st century Britain. If Down syndrome can be exterminated as easily as this, then how do those others now counted as the living disabled feel today? In the midst of an economic crisis already disproportionately hitting the living vulnerable, how long before the living disabled are considered a burden that society can no longer afford? Effectively, the UK's two main governments considered that question in early 2020 and then acted accordingly. Ms. Croter said of the judge's decision, "It makes me feel that I shouldn't be here, that I should be extinct. I know that's not true, but that's how it makes me feel." She then compared how the law views her, compared with her newborn nephew. "I was flabbergasted that the law protects him and not me." The decision in the Heidi Croter case also has disturbing parallels with what is being proposed in the Assisted Dying for the Terminally Ill Adults Scotland Bill being brought by the Liberal Democrat MSP, Liam MacArthur. In several other countries where euthanasia has been legalised, all the promised safeguards rapidly evaporate so that many more vulnerable people are caught up in the vortex. Serious illness can often lead to profound psychological distress and depression, but rather than work to alleviate this with targeted treatment, we point them in the direction of death. It's the quickest and most economically effective way out, after all. Mr. MacArthur's grievously ill-drafted bill wants to hand these poor people a gun, rather than provide genuine care for them. And if this can be achieved without any proper debate about funding better psychiatric and palliative care, then so much the better. A stealthy narrative is coiled around this, targeting vulnerable people and their families, that they are a financial and care drain on limited resources. The former Labour politician Dennis Canavan expressed these concerns much more eloquently than me. Mr. Canavan lost his four children, three of them after a terminal illness. "My children undoubtedly underwent some pain," he said, "but it was minimised by caring health professionals. As a result, my children died in dignity, and I do not accept that the option of assisted suicide is necessary to ensure dignity in death." Proponents of the proposed suicide legislation have spent almost a decade trying to get it over the line. A sophisticated marketing campaign and at least one suggestible national newspaper title have been pumping out propaganda to chip away at deep public unease. You wonder what they might have achieved if they had spent as much time and energy seeking to improve palliative care for terminally ill people rather than hurrying along their deaths. We have a culture of death in Scotland, though, where the quick fix of legalised killing is seen as the cost-effective path of least resistance. It will always beat improving life for people with complex end-of-life illnesses. This report was by Kevin McKenna. This article is from the Herald on Monday, the 28th of November, 2022. It's from the opinion section, and the headline is, "We all need to pay more for the NHS." The report is by Doug Marr. I'm very fortunate to have been well through my eighth decade before spending a single night in hospital. That all changed earlier this year on becoming ill in Gran Canaria. It came as a shock to learn I needed immediate surgery. The procedure was carried out around midnight at the island's public hospital. An interpreter was even on hand to explain what was to happen. The surgical and nursing team's skills and care probably saved my life. 10 days later, I walked out under my own steam with nothing to pay. Thank you, Spanish Health Service. Having never previously been hospitalised, I had nothing against which to judge my Spanish experience. The hospital was modern, large, and there seemed no shortage of high-tech equipment. The most noticeable feature, though, was staffing. There appeared to be medical, nursing, and ancillary staff everywhere. A Polish nurse explained he formerly worked at a London hospital, but had left after Brexit. Yet another Brexit bonus for Global Britain. It reminded me of Churchill's observation, "I see little glory in an empire which can rule the waves and is unable to flush its sewers, to which can be added or pay for its health service." On returning home, I was referred to the local hospital. There followed a 6-week wait for an appointment, the initial delay compounded by a further 2-month wait for treatment. Don't get me wrong, I've no complaint about the care I finally received. I can't help wondering, however, if the 4-month wait led to a worsening of my condition and a reduced chance of recovery. Since returning home, I've been able to compare my experiences in Gran Canaria and Scotland. We are rightly proud and fiercely defensive of the NHS and its staff. That shouldn't blind us to the fact that other countries like Spain have similar systems that deliver as good or even better patient outcomes. Yet they don't seem to be in permanent financial crisis. Recent personal experience makes me hugely appreciative of NHS staff. Despite their best efforts, however, the system is creaking ominously. In its most recent survey, the US-based Commonwealth Fund noted that NHS's slippage down the league table of comparable countries. One of the main reasons is delay in accessing treatment. That certainly chimes with my recent experience. Only this month, independent charity The Health Foundation reported the UK's spending on health as a proportion of GDP is lower than most comparable countries. The foundation concluded, "Either we are going to have lower quality healthcare relative to other countries, or we spend more." That stark message has been echoed by Scotland's NHS leaders, who have warned the present funding model is unsustainable. From its inception, there have been concerns about NHS funding. Its founding father, Aneurin Bevan, believed costs would fall as the nation's health improved. As it turned out, the NHS has been a victim of its own success. Improved healthcare has contributed to an ageing population, often requiring expensive care, placing the system under even more pressure. Ironically, improved standards of living have enabled more of us to undermine our own health through smoking and excessive alcohol consumption. Scotland's NHS is in critical condition. Given the current financial meltdown, it's questionable if the billions required can be found through the present funding model. A doctrinaire and increasingly desperate Tory government is likely to look to private providers, possibly in the US, for salvation. Inevitably, much needed funding would be diverted into the pockets of fat cat shareholders. There is another way. As health chiefs have suggested in one way or another, we all must pay more. Politically, free at the point of delivery appears sacrosanct, so it boils down to increased taxation and contributions. The Institute for Fiscal Studies has calculated that in 2019, the take from UK National Insurance represented 6.6% of GDP, as opposed to the average 12% over 14 other European countries. Yes, yes, I know you've paid National Insurance all your working life and can't be expected to pay more. Fair enough, but you'll have plenty of time to reflect on that when waiting hours for that ambulance or that extra few years for your hip replacement. That report was by Doug Marr.
And that was this week's The National Podcast, normally recorded in our studio at the Bishop Briggs Media Centre, currently recorded from our volunteers' homes with the publisher's kind permission. Thanks for listening.